I'm Sean Graham, and what's oldest news this week is the Fort McKay Métis Nation. Located in northern Alberta, the Fort McKay Métis Nation has quite the fascinating history and a rather unique historical context when compared to other communities in the surrounding area. And it is the subject of a new book by Peter Fortna entitled The Fort McKay Métis Nation, in which he traces the evolution of the community from the mid-19th century through to the 21st century. And what's interesting is he really explores the community through genealogy, land use, land tenure, response to government interventions into the community, specifically as it relates to resource extraction, specifically oil, and how all of these questions affected the people in the community and the relationships there, and how they changed over time. And you know, in going through the book and in talking with Peter, one of the more fascinating things that come out of the book to me is how the administrative designation of individuals as it relates to the federal government, how that impacted the community and relationships within the community, really does show just the power of colonial structures and colonial forces and the impact that they can have at a community level. So a really fascinating book. And Peter is not an academic historian, but you can see that he very much cares about the historical process, uses great resources here, including oral histories, but also deep archival research, community literature. It's a really well put together book about a community that certainly I was not particularly familiar with prior to going through the book and speaking with Peter, but one that very fascinating history from just the local perspective and the history of Fort McKay Métis Nation itself, but broader themes emerge from the book that are applicable to the colonial structures and policies that we have in Canada. So I was very excited to talk to Peter about the book. Enjoyed the conversation. Think you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Peter Fortna. All right. And Peter Fortna joins me now. Peter, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining me to talk about the Fort McKay Métis Nation. So let's start at the beginning here of the nation. And for anyone who maybe doesn't know about it or has this first time encountering the Fort McKay Métis Nation, let's talk first, where is it? Like, where are we talking geographically?
Yeah, no, Fort McKay, it's about 60 kilometers north of Fort McMurray. And right in the heart of the oil sands. So they're one of the most, if not the most impacted community by oil sands development, right on the Athabasca River. I mean, just briefly, their history's tied. They originally, it was a fort. So it was tied with the fur trade and a Hudson's Bay Company fort and a Northwest Company fort before that. And yeah, so they've got a long history in the area stretching back to the, you know, early 19th, late 18th century.
And for the Fort McKay Métis Nation itself, what's the origins of the nation proper as you track it in this book?
Sure. Well, I think there's a couple ways I can approach that question, right? And you'll see in the book. In my mind, Fort McKay kind of exists as its own indigenous community, whatever you want to call it, you know, beginning since time immemorial. And it's really, you know, rooted in those indigenous knowledge systems. You know, some people, for the Cree-speaking folks, Wahutoin. There's also Dene people in the community, so maybe the Dene laws, et cetera. And really those connections to the land. There's a really good line in one of the early reports written in the community, you know, that described the community as, you know, being inseparable from the land. And that's how they would view themselves, as being deeply in connected to the land and to that local area along the Athabasca River, etc. And then really that community continued existing sort of as the Fort McKay community or Fort McKay Indigenous community right into the 1960s. I think very few people would have saw themselves as either Métis or First Nations, anything other than a legal way, right? They saw themselves as Fort McKay people. They married one another. They were connected to one another. That continued, you know, from, like I said, from the late 18th century in right into the 1960s. The second way I could answer that question is more from a legalistic perspective. And from that, in that way, You had the treaty commissioners and the scrip commissioners coming through the region in 1899. For various reasons, they decided they had a scrip commission, which, would ascribe some people as to be Métis, and then they had a treaty commission, which would ascribe some people to be treaty. If you go back and read the actual files, the government themselves didn't have a strong understanding or reasoning as to why some people chose what, would choose treaty or would choose Métis scrip, and they didn't really necessarily put up many barriers for people choosing one or the other. It's hard to say why people chose one or the other. I mean, some reasons might have been economics, some reasons might have been, specific family members, etc. In Fort McKay, you'll see in the book, there was kind of two, there's three main families roughly. Two of them chose to become First Nation. They formed the core of what was to become Fort McKay First Nation. One of the three groups or three people chose Métis scrip or half-breed scrip, and they came to form kind of what would become the Métis community. But in reality, right into the 1960s, they were marrying one another and they would accept newcomers, etc. And then that would legally change their status from being First Nations or Métis, depending on the legal ramifications of the day. But in essence, they were still all living together. They were still all deeply enmeshed into the bush economy, involved in trapping and subsistence living, etc. That only really began to change in the 1960s when, the collapse of the fur trade and the federal government took responsibility for who were quote unquote First Nations people, whereas the provincial government, provincial policies took more responsibility for Métis people, and that started the more formal separation of the two groups, I would say. But, it's a bit of a misnomer or misnaming in a way to call the community that was one, prior to 1899 and only legally became ascribed as two separate communities by, a federal decision to say some people are this and other people are that.
And how much agency did the individuals, you mentioned those three families, how much agency did they have in that process? Because certainly there are stories of things being put upon Indigenous communities across the country by federal agents as they go around. So within these two commissions, the Treaty and Scrip Commission, what's that like in that moment?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer in a sense because, in all honesty, I don't think it had that much of an effect on the people themselves, right? Then, sure, you would go in and you would sign one or the other, and you would, if you chose scrip, you would get a one-time payment. If you chose treaty, you would get kind of ongoing commitments. But in those initial, especially in Treaty 8, in those initial years, there was no sort of reserve land. Well, there was some reserve land set aside, but people wouldn't really live on it per se. They would continue living in the bush, and Métis people would continue living in the bush as well. And they would continue trapping on their historic trap lines. They would continue selling furs to fur buyers. They would continue living as they've always lived, sharing the land and using it to meet their needs. Structurally, it only became really recognizable in the community, the difference between being Métis or First Nation in the 1960s when, the federal government started to formally build houses for folks and started to take greater, I don't want to say care, but that's not really the right language, but to be forced to take more responsibility, jurisdictional responsibility, and do more things and provide more investment in the community. Whereas Métis people were often left behind and weren't given some of those same opportunities. And as a result, that was really the beginning of the split between the two sides of the community and really the recognizable difference between sort of somebody having First Nation status or Métis status. But you'll see in many families and just the way the Indian Act worked, especially sort of prior to Bill C-31 coming in 1982, the government often wouldn't know the statuses of different people. And, if you were a Métis person, you married a First Nations person, that First Nations woman might lose her status, she might not, kids may lose their status, may not. if you have grandchildren, you might have grandchildren, some with status, some with not, without status. And so the community itself is fully integrated, fully one, and people didn't see those differences in status and really making a big difference in sort of how the community is organized. It's only, like I say, after the 1960s when those statuses become more formalized and they start to have different meanings, you know, within legal aspects, that you really see difference, you know. And even to this day, you see a lot of fluidity in the community. You see lots of people, as the government changes various policies, people who were Métis their whole lives getting First Nation status, or, you know, First Nations people whose kids aren't able to get First Nation status joining the Métis community, right? So that fluidity is a common, you know, throughout the whole history of Fort MacKay and one of its key defining features.
And I'm curious how much of that in the 1960s is, again, imposed by the structures in place versus members of the community uptaking that. And, you know, like, again, that quite, not as much the question of agency, but in terms of the meaning of the community, obviously there are these structures that are put in place that are kind of forcing this divide. But do you still have the same, say, social networks and community that's there, or do you see divides on that level as well?
Well, yeah. So I would say, you know, right to the 1960s. I mean, colonialism is obviously omnipresent, right? And right. But to the 1960s, I would say traditional governance in the community is able to overcome most of those impositions, right? Community is still well connected. Kinship networks are the primary form of organization. You know, decisions are made collectively. People are for subsistence. There are, you know, to make a living, they're primarily engaged in the fur economy. And, you know, that's just how everybody functions in Fort MacKay. By the 1960s is when you start to see, you know, major systemic changes. And there's a few key ones that we can trace. One of the first ones, well, you know, starts, I say, in the 1940s, is the imposition of the registered fur management system, or the creation of trap lines, in essence. Prior to the 1940s, the community would self-organize. You know, they would choose which trap lines they would use, often passed down through family and family knowledge. People would share resources and share space. The government in the 1940s, they take that space or those organizations and basically individualize it. So rather than, you know, a community or a family having an area, individuals now own specific areas within trap lines. You know, the communities are able to manage this in a sense, and that the government's not super prescriptive on who owns what lines. And then they try to work with communities, I think, to make sure that, you know, if a family or if an individual had used a line for a long time, that they got quote unquote ownership of that lease, you know, to continue using the line. But systemically, there becomes major problems, right? Because when a lease gets created, that means it can be bought, sold, traded, owned. So if a person, for whatever reason, decided to relinquish that lease or sell the improvements to somebody not from the community, that trap line lease is lost, you know, from the community forever, arguably, without community input. So, I mean, that's one of the first challenges. And the second challenge is, I think, at a higher level, is it's the government reorganizing how land is managed. So, you know, the people aren't given ownership, they're given leases of the land. And the government can give out competing leases. So by the 1960s, it's when you start to see, you know, the first large-scale industrial development in the region and the creation of the first oil sands project, Great Canadian Oil Sands, you know, 1964, 1967, or in that era. And because the government is issuing leases, if one lease is deemed to be more profitable, quote-unquote, than another lease, then the more profitable lease gains, you know, access to the land and just to pay, and is meant to pay those who are, you know, less profitable the difference. But the problem is, trapping was a way of life. Started, like I say, in the early 19th century, and it's not just, the value of the fur that a person would get off, that a family would get off the lease. It was everything else, the access to space, the access to, a place where you could build housing, et cetera, a place where you could raise your kids in the same place that your grandparents raised their kids and their great grandparents raised their kids and great great grandparents raised your kids. And understanding that land in an intimate way that we'll, as white settlers, we'll never fully appreciate. And then to transfer that to a massive, company who's going to transform the land to make it unrecognizable, causes a huge ripple through the community. Like I describe it, like a tidal wave coming down the Athabasca River. And then, sort of related to trap lines and coming a bit later, in the 1940s, you see the government in the north of the province create what they call the green zone. They create a green zone and a white zone. And in essence, in the green zone territory, what more commonly today is known as crown land, it becomes land that's reserved by the province for the needs of the province. At the time, seen more for forestry, but perhaps with an eye to future types of development. But what that does is, for communities like Fort MacKay, it makes land virtually unownable. So you create, in a lot of these rural indigenous communities, they become squatters on their own land, land that they've occupied for, thousands of years in some cases, right? So as a result, initially, well, I should back up. Initially, it's not as big a deal as you might think, because people are largely semi-sedentary. They're moving onto their trap lines. They're, living their lives. They're quite mobile. By the 1960s, though, you see the first real collapse in fur, and for the first time, people aren't able to make enough money trapping to cover their basic needs. So poverty, for the first time, comes into the north. And then when you pile on top of that poverty the inability to own land, it becomes really challenging in the communities. And so people become sort of pressured. And because you can't own land, you can't do things like make improvements to the land. You might be able to get a miscellaneous lease and build like a temporary structure, but you can't actually, get things like a mortgage, or you can't start a business, right? So, and there's no basic infrastructure built in these places either. So as people begin to congregate more around, more permanently around places, you start to see the pressures of, living in close proximity. How do you get water to a community? How do you get sewer to a community? Those types of issues. At the same time, too, the government begins implementing rules around everybody has to attend day school. So where some people may not have received formal education, prior to 1960, the government says, well, you need to start going to day school, especially if you're going to get any type of social assistance. That's when the family allowance checks begin. So as a result, people begin moving to more central spaces like Fort MacKay, but without proper infrastructure and without the ability to own land. That leads, the government, I think, recognizes that problem, if for no other reason than newspaper reporters start traveling up to these northern communities and writing stories and really demonstrating the level of poverty that's beginning to exist. So the government's first response is, well, we'll give these communities leases. So we'll give community leases. And that's where Fort MacKay gets their first lease, I think 1967, 68. And on that, and great, like you, but the problem with that is then you become face to face with the structure of government again. With that lease, you have to make regular payments on it. You have to start paying taxes. You have to start providing infrastructure, except the government doesn't provide any of the infrastructure. They say, here's some land, fill your boots. Oh, and by the way, you now owe us, taxes every year, and we won't help you individualize the land. We won't help you set up the structures to create subleases so individuals can own leases. We won't put in even the most basic of infrastructure, into the land, water, sewer, et cetera. And we understand that, you know, your core industry has completely collapsed for the fur economy, but we're not going to provide any investment to create a new economy, whether that's forestry or otherwise, which the many northern communities, including Fort McKay, were clamoring for. So as a result, the communities become, in essence, welfare communities, increasingly, you know, dependent on the state, and without any ability to provide basic needs in the community, and falling further and further behind in their taxes. So, you know, they begin owing the state money without any ability to pay it off, or, you know, being given land that they lived on their whole lives, you know, and their grandparents and great grandparents had lived on, and without getting any of the benefits of the industrial development that's happening just down the road, or just down the river, I should say. And I just recently wrote a blog about that too, showing, you know, as industrial development came, you start to have to deal with things like pollution in the river. So people begin becoming sick from drinking river water, something that would have been unfathomable, you know, a generation prior, right? So all these things pile together and sort of hit crushing blows in the 1960s, 1970s that really make Fort McKay a difficult place to restructure in a functioning community. And I think quickly the community came to, you know, sadly, in a way too, the community comes to recognize that their traditional governance systems, you know, Wahutawin, the Dene laws, you know, how they'd always organize themselves, are not going to be effective in dealing with this new state. I mean, some people, settler colonialism, some folks use, I think, more to the oil sands, people are using the term extractivism, which is probably more appropriate because it's sort of the state leading all this development, you know, in partnership with industry as opposed to, you know, individual settlers. But whatever you want to call it, you know, this community is coming face to face with the state in a way that they've never done before, and the state is just, you know, taking and taking and taking without giving anything back to the community. And, you know, how is a community with probably virtual illiteracy, you know, a handful of people have been to day school, to deal with major oil sands companies and government officials coming in and, you know, transforming the landscape around them in ways that they could have never, as I say, never could have imagined a generation earlier.
The book then gets into how a lot of these issues, and listening to you talk, the book gets into how divisive a lot of this is within the community. And it strikes me in reading it and going through and listening to your answer there that I could see this almost being a unifying point for the community against these colonial structures that are in place. But you really talk, the book gets into the divisive nature of this. And I'm just curious in looking at this, especially the perspective that the book takes, because it is this community history, how are people responding to this imposition of the government and these structures that are in place and the damage that's being done? And if you could just maybe describe a bit the divisive
Sure.
nature of what's happening as a result of this.
Yeah, and maybe the best example is focusing for a moment on that land tenure issue. So, sort of prior to that, those leases being formed and stuff, and really almost right after Great Canadian Oil Sands starts in 1860 or 1967, you see the community starting trying through their traditional modes of organization, try to come together and go to government and say, look, we don't have land here. We would really like you to come to a solution. So they form, you know, the Fort McKay Community Association, I think they call themselves originally. It's not, I mean, they weren't formally incorporated, so the name changes in the archival record. But they go to the government and say, look, we want a solution to this problem. And eventually they get meetings with the federal government and the provincial government and say, look, we the people of Fort McKay, you know, we recognize some of us are ascribed as Métis, some of us are ascribed as First Nations, but we collectively would like you to help us solve this problem of us getting ownership of the land before, you know, we get completely run over. and they end up in 5 years of meetings with, you know, the federal government, the provincial government, you know, oscillating between they're going to do something and they're not going to do something. And, you know, just bureaucratic stasis because they don't know how to deal with, you know, these different statuses of people. And ultimately what ends up happening in about 1967, 68, I think, is maybe a bit later, sorry. The provincial government or the federal government says, look, we're going to start building houses for First Nations. That's within our view. We have land set aside. We're going to start doing that. And eventually the Métis, the provincial government similarly sets aside the lease and, you know, thinks that's a great solution, although, like I say, they don't provide any support. So that begins this process of separating the community. And despite the community went to the state saying, we want to be dealt with together, we want to work together to solve our community problems. And the state, the provincial and federal government is saying, we are incapable of working with you as a single entity. We're going to separate you yet again, and we'll deal, you know, one part of the state will deal with you here, the other part of the state will deal with you over there. And despite that, you know, the community still tries to come together. And, you know, 1979, when the new land tenure program gets initiated and they start to try to individualize the various Métis leases across the province, including Fort MacKay, Jim Boucher, who future chief of Fort MacKay First Nation, and then he's an administrator for the First Nation, goes to the provincial government and says, look, we Fort MacKay would like to function together as a single government and manage all this land on behalf of the community members as a whole. And, you know, the provincial government says, no, we're not going to deal with you with any federal Indians. We're worried you might turn that land into reserve land, which we oppose. The Métis have their own land. You guys can get your own land and whatever. So it's really the federal government and the provincial government and with the federal government that's unable to, again, deal with those challenges. And, you know, through the 1980s and into the 1990s, I think those initial decisions by the government and the inability, the unimaginative ability of the bureaucracy to deal with these challenges, you know, forces the community to be more and more separate. And eventually, as legal precedence changes, especially in the 1990s and early 2000s, you know, there becomes real benefits to that. You know, the initial benefits in the 80s is largely housing and access to it and some basic administrative capacity, but you know, the First Nations and Métis continue to work together. But over time, as the state starts to mandate that oil companies need to provide, you know, more access to capital, you know, based on impacts, and because First Nations end up having more, at that time at least, seem to have more legal rights, they get better agreements, better deals, and eventually more money. And as a result, there becomes a real economic divide in the community that you can see through the 1990s, 2000s, 2000s and 10s and the aughts that really create, you know, these, that really emphasize these divisions in the community. Now, I mean, those divisions on one hand, you know, they do matter. You know, some people are becoming more economically, are getting access to more economic opportunities than other people in the same community. But on the other hand, as I mentioned before, everyone's still related to one another. You know, all the First Nation, many of the First Nations people were Métis themselves once, you know, and got status through Bill C-31 and through various changes in the law. Many of them have Métis aunts and uncles. Many of them would go hunting together and share trap lines together. So it's still a connected community, but unfortunately, economically, there's significant difference. And I mean, that ultimately forces the Métis to kind of, you know, reorganize and, you know, in the 2010s, 2020s, and, you know, really fully, they're two separate communities now, or two separate nations, I should say. But on the other hand, they're still very closely connected and still share, you know, a common origin and common relatives and everything else.
Right. It's the classic. The answer to all your questions is money. That's really what it always comes down to is, it always comes down to the economic forces are really impossible to ignore in a lot of these cases. And certainly oil, as you mentioned, plays a huge role in the story and the extractive economy, for sure. So, as people, it's interesting too, as people are looking at this book, the separation between the two communities, these issues are not in the past by any means. These are certainly still contemporary issues as you talk about. So as you're, I'm curious about sort of the drafting of the book, the putting it together. As the author of it and you're coming to this material, you are working with the community members. You're there and you have to engage with folks. What is that process like for you, given that there is this very unique history of a community that has been or for has this traditional history together, but as you mentioned, there's some divisive issues at play. Just as an author, historian, what was that process like?
Well, I should back up a bit, and I mean this is covered in the book too. I came at this at a bit of a unique position in that I was an employee of the community, right? I was arguably the first or one of the first staff people the Métis ever hired, and I was dealing with a lot of with the aftermath of a lot of these problems as they came up, and kind of with my historical training, of course, I started to wonder how, like as I say in the book, how did this come to be? Like, okay, we have land in the community. We have various people living on the land, but none of them seem to be Métis community members anymore. Well, how did this happen? Right? And various other related issues. The book itself was it was initially a report I helped the community draft, and it's related to kind of Métis communities in Alberta trying to get access to the same rights and privileges that First Nations people get. And the government of Alberta has created what they call the credible assertion process, which is kind of ridiculous in a sense, in that it's forcing Métis communities to prove that they exist, despite the fact, like in Fort McKay's case, they've existed for 200 years, and why they need a white historian to write that history is kind of beyond me. But the benefit, I suppose, if there is any, and there really isn't. But one of the few benefits is it gave an opportunity to start to revisit some of those questions that I probably would have never had a chance to look at, as an employee and then as a consultant. So I guess that's the first place I came at the writing of the story. And some of the later chapters especially became more of a COVID project in that I was talking to the community. We were all looking for things to do, and I said, "Look, I've got all this other material that didn't go in the report. Wouldn't it be great to turn it into a book?" And they agreed, so they kind of gave me a little bit of money and a little bit of time and access. I think your question too is tied, okay, how do you involve the community in doing such a project? And I mean, through my consulting practice, I do a lot of oral history. That's one of the core things that we do. We recently wrote a book based on some of that oral history with a different another community, the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, their relationship to Wood Buffalo National Park. But in approaching this project, I think it became clear that the oral history was, of course, valuable, and they had done other oral history projects, and I referenced some of them in the book. But in this case, it was more we needed to understand how, like, what were the government processes in my mind that really created the community of created the Fort McKay First or Métis Nation, right? So that got me to doing more of what I would call a traditional history and, digging through the archives, understanding what some of those policies and decisions and, finding out what the government's thought process was in various pieces. And in doing that, though, I found it connected well with the community, and that, when you're dealing only or primarily with oral histories, you only ever really get to understand how people respond to those policies, right? We had a trap line, now we don't have it anymore. I don't know, we've never had land, and I don't know why we've never had land. But by being able to go back to the archives and understand these processes and understand government thought processes, read letters from, you know, Chief Dorothy MacDonald, who, you know, sadly passed away before her time, and to get the access to some of her files that her husband Rod Hyde had saved for years, and to read through that material, you know, gave an opportunity to really, you know, say, oh, aha, that's what happened. That's what's happening here. And then taking that information and connecting it to some of the oral histories, like, you're explaining this to me. Now I understand why that happened, how it came to be. Right. So in that sense, this book probably has less oral histories than I would typically have in a report. But I think it was important to get that sort of core and administrative history of this community largely, so that we had a baseline on when, so that those lived experiences that people describe, you know, can be situated within sort of an institutional understanding of what's going on.
And should note too that the book is open source, and so there's a lot of resources available, and we will link down to the page in the show notes below. But why was that important to you and to the community? Because obviously, based on what you just said, they had input into the final product here a little bit. So why was that an important part of this project for you?
So I'd give two reasons. One is, sort of as an independent scholar, nothing is more frustrating than not having access to, you know, source material, right? I don't have a university affiliation. So anytime an article or a book gets published often with a university press or with, you know, ProQuest or whatever, Congrobulator or whatever you want to call it. I don't think that's a word, but aggregator, I think is what I was trying to say. You know, you lose access to that information. You can't even have a conversation with it. You can't look at it. Neither can the communities often to which this material is written about. So, and arguably often it's material that's written, you know, if you're a university professor doing this work, you know, with government resources, right? Whether it's a SHRC grant, et cetera. And I know some of that is changing, and I know SHRC's encouraging people to publish more open source and make their material open access, but it's super frustrating. I didn't want to be part of that system. So, you know, I'm making a conscious effort to find publishers that will make the material open and open source. And relatedly, not just the book itself, but also as much as possible, some of the gray literature and archival material that ironically academics have a hard time accessing. You know, if you don't live in Edmonton, you know, getting to the provincial archives can be difficult. So I thought, well, you know, I've got the material collected. I have one view of it. Maybe somebody else is going to want to read it, and they'll have a differing view of it. Right. So why not make it available and, you know, move more towards getting this information out into the open and available for anybody. Second reason, I guess, is, you know, a lot of the communities I work for, and I guess ignoring for a second the reality of the digital divide, but I mean, the digital divide is narrowing every time. They might not have the resources to go and buy the book, or they might only want to see a small snippet of it, or they might, you know, want to look up a relative in it or something. And, you know, this way they can perhaps even through Google find the book and see their family members represented in it and in this story. And, you know, I think there was a time in the past where community level histories were, you know, more popular. People were more apt to write them, but that time, for whatever reason, it seemed to pass. But I really value that level of analysis, and I think it can really help to tell, you know, local level stories, and especially for a community like Fort MacKay that's dealt with so much over the years, and with, you know, topics like extractivism and such becoming back in vogue, I guess. I thought it was valuable to kind of make this available and say, look, here's the story of an actual community that's dealing with these issues on a day-to-day basis, and this is how they did it, and this is how they're continuing to do it.
Yeah,
so I think those would be the reasons.
Yeah, and it's a really well put together story, and great that all the resources are there. So again, it's the Fort MacKay Métis Nation, a community history. Peter, if people want to find a copy of the book or a copy of the material and keep up with everything else you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, if they want to keep up with what I'm going on, I'm on Blue Sky or I'm still around Twitter, so you can look me up there, just Peter Fortna or at Peter Fortna. The book itself, it's with the University of Calgary Press, so that's a good place to find it. You should be able to also get it at various bookstores. And like most things, it's a Google search away if either of those two methods fail you.
Yeah, and like I said, we will link below to the University of Calgary Press page for it, so be sure to check it out. Again, the Fort McKay Métis Nation, a community history. Peter Fortna, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. It's really a pleasure. You don't often get a chance to talk about your work, so I appreciate the opportunity.
So there you have it, my chat with Peter Fortna, and I thank him for his time. And again, the book is The Fort McKay Métis Nation, a community history. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which today is going to come from the Calgary Herald, an article by Chris Nelson on March 25th, 2021, titled Fort McKay Métis Nation Builds Booming Business in Oil Sands Sector. And in this article, Chris Nelson goes through and profiles the relationship between Indigenous communities and oil companies, energy companies, and how this collaboration, how these relationships have shaped the industry and the economics of these communities. So in the case of the Fort McKay Métis Nation in 2019, they purchased the land that they live on from the Alberta government, at which point the community announced plans for further expansion and using that land that was officially purchased from the province for greater economic development and growth. So it's a very much a different financial structure to oil deals. And according to the article, it's something that potentially could be a model for other communities, giving more agency to the Fort McKay Métis Nation. But of course, there are questions with the broader structure of this, and of course, resource extraction in general and the long-term ramifications of that. So it's a fascinating policy change, as well as questions related to community agency over economic affairs and relationships between local communities and provincial and, of course, federal governments. So a fascinating case here with the Fort McKay Métis Nation, and that is today's historical headline of the week from Calgary Herald, March 25, 2021, by Chris Nelson. Fort McKay Métis Nation builds booming business in oil sands sector. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Like, rate, comment, all the good stuff. Helps other people find the show and keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab, plus all the great written material over on the site. And as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, it's oldestnews@gmail.com. So with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old is News.